Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Commerce Department said this morning consumer spending was up again last month. Good news, actually, because an economic recovery is a tricky thing without you and me opening our wallets. It's how we're spending that's the problem. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix, offering Go to My PC, providing remote access to a Mac or a PC from anywhere. More at gotomypc.com/market. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Monday, today the 29th of March, and it is good to have you with us. February made it 5 months in a row that consumer spending has gone up. We've mentioned, I don't know how many times on the broadcast, that consumers account for almost three-quarters of the economy in this country. So spending going up is good, until you know that incomes are flat. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
Patrick Fitzpatrick has loosened up his wallet recently. The 41-year-old dad from Erie, Colorado, found a job in February after 5 months of unemployment, and he's feeling more secure.
We'll start piano lessons again for my daughter, and we just bought a cell phone for my son. Gone out to dinner a couple times. Just little things.
Economists say Fitzpatrick's like many Americans right now. They're spending slightly more, but not on big-ticket items like cars or kitchen remodels. And many are paying with cash, not credit. That's reflected in last month's savings rate, which slipped to its lowest level since October 2008. Still, economist Alan Levinson at T. Rowe Price sees reason for hope.
As spending recovers, there's a demand for more goods and services to be produced, which requires more people to produce them. So it also implies job growth to come.
But analyst Kim Whalen at Wells Fargo says when she dug into the numbers, she discovered nearly half the rise in February household spending came from an increase in things like unemployment benefits and tax refunds.
Jobs are coming back slowly, so income will pick up in line with that, but we're not expecting a quick recovery.
And many Americans won't be quick to splurge their way back to that recovery. Fitzpatrick says his family will continue to scour sales and thrift stores to help rebuild their savings. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
You know that thing I say at the end of the numbers most days, the yield on the 10-year T-note? I completely understand if all that goes in one ear and out the other, but those who have been paying attention to the interest rate on Treasury notes, they're noticing something kind of worrying. As the economy slowly recovers, the yield on the 10-year has gone from about 3.5% in February to almost 4% today, which means it's getting more expensive for Washington to borrow. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson explains.
Part of the reason the yield is rising is because who needs a safe haven anymore? Just as investors flocked to government bonds when the economy tanked, now they're heading back into higher risk, higher return investments. Guy Labat is chief fixed income strategist at Janney Montgomery Scott.
I'm going to say it's 75% yield chasing. People moving out of treasuries into other higher returning investments, and maybe 25% concerns about the long-term health of the United States.
He's talking about the trillions of dollars of debt we've racked up as a nation, something economists worry could make investors nervous about lending to the government in the future. On Bloomberg Television Friday, former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan said the debt picture is an early warning sign for the economy.
It's going to have a marked impact eventually, unless it's contained, on long-term rates, and that will make a housing recovery very difficult to implement and put a dampening on capital investment as well.
That's because as bond yields go up, consumers often have to pay more to borrow as well. Still, PIMCO market strategist Tony Crescenzi says the recent rise in yields is no cause for panic.
Look, in fact, at the long-term rates and expect that they might rise a bit, but expect that they won't rise too much because the headwinds on the economy, the long-term structural impairments to industries, for example, will remain.
He says don't forget the number 9.7, that's the unemployment rate, which he says will hold inflation and the cost of borrowing down. And Guy Labat points out that the most recent Treasury auctions, the ones causing all this fuss, still had plenty of bids for every dollar of debt. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
In Shanghai, China today, a major corporate corruption case came to an end. Four executives at the British-Australian mining conglomerate Rio Tinto were sentenced up to 14 years in prison. The four, one of whom we should say is an Australian citizen, were charged with accepting bribes and stealing commercial secrets. The company called that deplorable. They fired the lot of them. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more now on what the ruling might mean for other foreign firms doing business in China.
In the 1980s and 90s, China rolled out the welcome mat for foreign companies. As the country built a new economy, Chinese officials wanted their knowledge and money. But analysts say the harsh sentences handed out to the four Rio Tinto executives show times have changed. Ted Fishman wrote the book China, Inc. He says the ruling could make it harder for foreign companies to do business in a country where corruption is outlawed but widespread.
If you abide by the rules, you'll be at a disadvantage. And if you break the rules, you'll always be open for legal action when the Chinese find it advantageous to move against you.
Fishman says because the court proceedings were so murky, it's hard to know exactly what the executives did. Rio Tinto quickly distanced itself from its employees. The company said any wrongdoing was done outside its systems. China is the company's biggest customer. John DeLury is with the Asia Society's Center on U.S.-China Relations. He says all this could make employees nervous, and he says they can't rely on getting a fair shake in the courts.
The combination of these things would give pause, I think, to employees of multinationals who are trying to navigate that kind of environment.
DeLury says that could make it harder to recruit in China, but with the Chinese economy booming, he says brave souls will continue to jump in. They may just do so with a little more caution. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There was some measured caution on Wall Street this Monday. All three major indices did gain some ground, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The stereotypical newsroom, the way a lot of people imagine it, probably involves reporters writing or on the phone, editors holding planning meetings over by the whiteboard over there, and in general, a fair amount of hubbub. At Inc. magazine headquarters in New York City last month, you might have witnessed the occasional tumbleweed cross from cubicle to cubicle. That's because the entire issue was created by reporters and editors working from home. Jane Berenson is the editor of Inc. magazine, which makes the case for the virtual office in this month's issue. Jane, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Where did this idea come from?
We had wanted to do a story for a while about what it was like to work in a virtual office, and I assigned it to our senior writer, Max Chafkin, who then said, why don't we report that story but also go virtual at the same time? He would report on other companies and also report on our experience at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, you're getting the issue out, so things presumably went okay. But how was it on the inside? You know, I mean, what was it like going to work in your jammies every day?
Well, it was different for different people. So I think there are some people who were a bit skeptical before we started it and thought, no, we really have to come to an office. A magazine's a collaborative venture. But one of those people, for instance, decided that why do we ever have to come to the office again? Because he could get, you know, out of his bed, you know, roll 20 feet to his desk, still in his pajamas, save $300 a month on commuting, and thought it was great. There were other people. I personally, for instance, missed the social and collaborative aspect of coming to an office.
There is that element, though, of social and collaborative work that doesn't work out so well. People pop into your office and it completely messes up your flow and you lose your place in an edit or whatever you're writing. I mean, it goes both ways.
It absolutely goes both ways. I know that I do have a tendency to leave my office and walk through the office making comments or interrupting people, and they're all very good-natured about it, but I think there are probably times when they just wish I would just stay in my office or, excuse me, not come to work in the first place.
You know, when you hear the phrase, oh, he's working from home today, there's a little thing that runs through your mind that says, oh, come on, how much work can you really get done at home? Because the dog has to go out and the kids have to get to school and you have to do this and the garbage is coming. And seriously, really, you're working from home?
I think there's a prejudice that goes around that phrase because I think that it has been a signal of, no, you do have things to do and you're not really going to work. So you have to take on good faith if you're going to do something like this, that when someone says they're working from home, they really mean they're working from home. And I would say our experience indicated that actually people worked much harder at home than they do in the office, because they would get into a zone and keep working. And I think this was true to a lot of the writers on staff.
What about that little bit of extra something, that little bit of pizzazz that comes to a story because somebody looks over somebody else's shoulder and says, you know what, yeah, right here, if you said this, it'd be just so much better?
I think if one was to grow up in a situation where you were virtual, all those things would work themselves out. So, for instance, we are used to, you know, looking over the shoulder, but if that's not the way we were trained to work, we would find other ways of doing the same thing. One of the things we loved was Skype.
Phone calls over your computer and video as well.
Phone call over the computer. You can see the person you're talking to. You can hold things up. I made people take me on a house tour. And they would walk around with their laptop and say, here's my kitchen and here's my living room. And it was fun. But also, you did have that very, well, nice feeling of being together.
Jane Berenson, the editor of Inc. magazine, the upcoming issue of which was produced entirely outside their offices in Manhattan. Jane, thanks very much.
Thank you.
For those who haven't quite decided yet whether to buy an iPad or not, you're going to have to wait just a little while longer. Apple announced this weekend they're backed up a bit. Folks who signed up early get their iPads Saturday. Late orderers won't get their new toys till April the 12th or perhaps later. Commentator Farhad Manju says that even though the iPad is, as yet, untested, that's still no reason to delay.
There's certainly ample historical evidence that being an early adopter isn't smart. The first generations of new gadgets are usually more expensive, buggier, and offer fewer features than later generations. Let's say you bought the first iPod way back on November 10, 2001. You would have paid $400 for 5 gigabytes of space for your music. Within the first year, Apple dropped the price to $300. That's how it goes in tech. A better, cheaper version is always around the corner. The trouble is, if you're always waiting for next year's device, you'll never buy anything. At some point, you've got to accept that tomorrow's cheaper, more advanced versions aren't around today, and then go to the store and see what's available in the present. Lucky for you, buying today's newest gadget is no longer so precarious. Not long ago, every product's features were fixed in time. But the internet has become something like a fountain of youth for gadgets. Through online updates, your gadgets can easily obtain new features regardless of when you purchase them. There are some products you should hold off on buying early. Gadgets that rely on new media formats are always risky. For example, it didn't make sense to buy a Blu-ray player until recently, when its rival HD DVD format kicked the bucket. But the iPad doesn't fall into that category. Because it has a web browser, your iPad will always have access to a wide range of applications and content that's not going away. What's more, Apple can quickly make changes to the device to satisfy any customer complaints. Sure, you might be able to get a cheaper one next year, and Apple might add a camera or a faster processor. But if none of that matters to you and you can't wait, don't. If you buy the iPad on day one and hate it, just take it back. If you love it but no one else does, don't worry. You'll get years of great service from your iPad, even if Apple decides to discontinue it by Christmas.
Farhad Manju covers technology for Slate. You can take a minute to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Apple shares today, by the way, all-time high, $232 a share. Coming up, when school is work.
You constantly thinking when you're on the job. They make you think. You have to use your noodle, like, seriously.
But first, let's do the numbers. Prospects of a consumer comeback push markets up today. The Dow Industrials gained 0.4%, 45 points, closed at 10,895. The NASDAQ picked up 0.3%, 9 points, finished at 2,404. The S&P 500 put on 0.5%. That is 6 points, ended the day at 1,173. Financial shares were mixed. Morgan Stanley advanced 2%. Bank of America deposited 0.75%. JPMorgan Chase forfeited 0.33%. On the transportation front, Ford backed up more than 2% today after a Chinese automaker agreed to buy Ford's Volvo unit for $1.8 billion. Too bad Ford bought it for, you know, $6 billion, low these many years ago. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.87%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard. Reacting to the stock market is investing. Taking stock in long term is vanguarding. More about vanguarding at vanguard.com. And by Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, President Obama meets with French President Sarkozy at the White House. The Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index on attitudes towards spending. And snow days can be bad for business. A study showing the economic costs of snowstorms in 16 states and Canada is unveiled at the National Press Club. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Major League Baseball announced today that President Obama is going to throw out the first pitch for the Washington Nationals home opener next Monday. That'll mark the 100th anniversary of the first time a president officially opened a baseball season. William Howard Taft was the first, by the way. One thing that's not such a part of the excitement around the sport anymore is baseball cards. It used to be that kids would buy a pack, get themselves a stick of gum, they'd collect the cards, and if they could see clear to part with them at some point, sometimes sell them at a profit. Not really the case anymore. Dave Jamieson's new book about the decline and fall of baseball cards is called Mint Condition. Dave, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kai. Thanks for having me.
Take 30 seconds for me, would you, and run us through the history of baseball cards in America, how they started and how they got to where they are.
We first started to see them in big numbers back in the 1880s. This was an ingenious idea, courtesy of a few tobacco moguls in the South, who decided to start slipping pictures of ballplayers and actresses into cigarette packs. This really started quite a fad where kids would beg their fathers to buy one brand over another because they wanted the baseball cards. And this kind of marketing scheme was replicated in other industries, the gum industry, the candy industry, until around the 1950s, you know, when Topps came along. And really, baseball cards at that point were no longer kind of an extra thrown in to sweeten the pot. They really became the main feature themselves. And they've really been their own industry ever since then.
How did you come to write this book?
Well, it all started about 4 years ago when my parents sold the house I grew up in, and my mom called me up and told me to head back to New Jersey and clear out my closet. And when I got back there, I found an enormous box of baseball cards. I took very good care of them, kept them all in excellent or mint condition. I assumed that someday it would be time to gather these up and sell them for a great amount of money and maybe start my retirement that way.
But who's buying these cards these days? That's the question.
So I started calling up the numbers to card shops and was surprised to find that a lot of the numbers were disconnected. So then I headed to eBay and Craigslist and found that these cards that I assumed were so valuable were actually quite worthless. You know, this really all goes back to what I call the great baseball card bubble of the late 80s and early 90s.
A bubble we've never heard of. We've had .com, had real estate, but now here's another one.
You know, when I was growing up in the 80s, there was this idea that baseball cards were valuable. That's because many old cards like, you know, Mickey Mantles and Willie Mays, those cards were selling for a great amount of money. So a lot of us kids tucked them away thinking that the cards that we were gathering as kids would accrue this value over time. And that never quite happened. And the reason for that is because card companies really overproduced the cards, and all of us held on to them. And it was years until we realized that these cards were really not worth what we thought they were.
And in fact, you write about this. Going to card shows today, you're what, like 30-something years old, right?
I'm 31, yeah.
Yeah, and you're the youngest guy in the place, right?
Yeah, a lot of times, yeah. part of this is the problem, as I said, there was this speculative bubble that once it popped, it turned off a lot of adults and kids. Packs were what used to be a dollar or 50 cents got up to $20 and more. And really, the hobby just kind of got a little out of control. It was difficult for kids to wrap their heads around all this product, and they couldn't afford it either. So eventually, they just kind of fled for Pokemon and video games and other things. And it's been very hard to lure children back to this industry.
You know what we need? We need an iPhone app for baseball cards. You can just see that,
you know, right? Very funny you say that. I just got an email the other day from a guy who was thinking along the exact same lines.
I'm telling you, I want to cut, actually, if this actually turns into anything.
Well, you'll be able to make your own customized Kai Ryssdal baseball card.
Yeah, and finally, maybe I'll get my kid to pay attention to me. Dave Jamieson, his book is called Mint Condition, How Baseball Cards Became an American Obsession. Dave, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Kai.
If you accept the proposition that high school is supposed to get kids ready for either college or work, then what's the best way to do that? Specifically, what's the best way to do it when the kids are from low-income urban neighborhoods? One way is to make working part of the curriculum. The Chicago-based Cristo Rey Network of Catholic High Schools has been doing that for more than 10 years. It runs schools in tough neighborhoods in 22 cities across the country. Lori Stern from American Radio Works joined incoming freshmen at orientation at Holy Family Cristo Rey in Birmingham, Alabama.
Good morning. How are you, Ryan? Have we done a handshake this morning? Okay.
The handshake, the business way. Firm grip, look the other person in the eye. Don't mumble your good morning.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Nikki Ming. I work for Regents Financial Human Resources Department as a recruiting coordinator.
Orientation takes place in the summer before school starts. The ninth graders learn what employers expect on the job, how to dress and speak professionally. The goal is that on the first day of work, each student should act like a worker, not a teenager.
Can you sign in for me?
Carlin Harris is 17 years old and a junior at Holy Family. He's been in the program 3 years. Every Wednesday, he mans the reception desk at the Innovation Depot, a business incubator in downtown Birmingham.
You're constantly thinking when you're on the job. They make you think. You have to use your noodle, like, seriously.
Carlin's supervisor is Jerry O'Toole.
I've been able to give Carlin computer work, where he's gone and has done QuickBooks spreadsheets. Everything he does is right on the money.
Carlin is set to graduate high school in 2011. He wants to become a surgeon. He's a good example of how the Holy Family approach is supposed to work. Show low-income students they can have a better future if they apply themselves.
The DNA of doing that is perseverance.
Here's Father Alex Steinmiller, the school president.
It's patience. It's long-suffering. Any word you want to use. That's the value that the cycle of poverty chews up. The value of maintaining a goal and maintaining a dream.
Students at Holy Family don't have to be Catholic, but they do have to take a Catholic theology course every day. And every class opens with a prayer. In biology, it's Avis Moore's turn to lead.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is.
Avis Moore is a ninth grader and a sharp dresser. Today, Avis is wearing a gray patterned vest and black tie over a crisp white shirt.
I'm trying to start in business, you know, lawyer, office work, stuff like that. And if that doesn't work out, I'm going to fashion.
This winter, Avis started working Fridays at a clinic at the University of Alabama Hospital, where he greets patients and files medical records. The clinic gets a different student worker from Holy Family every day of the week and pays the school an entry-level salary. In Birmingham, that's $21,500. That money offsets Holy Family's sliding scale tuition. Avis Moore's mother, Vanessa, pays $45 every 2 weeks, or about $1,000 a year. Vanessa is 41, a part-time cashier at two discount stores. Most nights, she comes home bone-tired to a rented house that she keeps dark to save on the electric bill.
Why does my house smell like it smells?
She says she rides both her sons hard to keep them out of trouble.
Did you take the garbage out?
Yeah.
Yes, I'll take the garbage out.
Did anybody mop my floors in here?
No, I just got in.
The Moore's household is typical for Holy Family. low income, single parent, and ready to sacrifice so the children can get ahead.
I dropped out of high school in 11th grade. I didn't really have that parental push, you know what I'm saying? Like I pushed them, I didn't have that. That's because I'm so hard on them by education. It's very important to get it because you don't want to be like me, working retail jobs, making a little money for, you know, I want y'all to do better than what I do.
Some of the students here that come from such destitute homes, you don't know it because they come here with a smile, because they're happy to be here, they're happy to be away from home. They see that college is about to happen and I can get away from home. Some of them see it, some of them don't.
Jan Fuller directs Holy Family's corporate internship program, which works with companies like accounting firm Deloitte & Touche, Alabama Public Television, and about 60 other employers. Back at Innovation Depot, junior Carlin Harris is one of the ones who sees it. Carlin says he was intimidated at first, but after 3 years on the job, he's become confident.
You know, you mold yourself because now I'm able to speak to people, speak out in class more. You become more profound. They make you become more than what you really are.
Carlin Harris is a Holy Family success story, and Holy Family is a Birmingham success story. Holy Family has readied 150 students for the workplace, and despite the recession, it's found job placements for all of them. This is Lori Stern for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix, offering GoToMyPC, providing remote access to a Mac or a PC from anywhere. More at gotomypc.com/market. And by Putnam Investments, helping investors save for retirement since 1937. For the latest retirement news, you can talk to your advisor, then visit RothIRAblog.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, today's shares of Citigroup lost 3% on this Monday. That's down to almost $4 a share. No particular reason you ought to care about that, except that we all own 27% of that bank after the TARP bailout. The Treasury Department said today it's going to unload all of its Citi shares this year in an orderly fashion, the press release promises. Probably ought to point out that if the stock stays somewhere near where it is today, we'll net a $7 billion profit from Citi. Nearly all of the $100 or so billion dollars in losses that the TARP is expected to cost us came from the car companies and AIG as well. And that said, that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow added 0.4%, 45 points. The NASDAQ ticked up 0.3%, 9 points. The S&P 500 put on 0.5%, 6 points. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this program, one part of kosher and halal that people sometimes forget.
You also have to make sure that the whole life that it lived also was one where that had dignity and mercy. And in a farm like this, the animals, they're treated practically like family.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.